It was quite a trip,
said Hagbard Chileen.
You're quite a tripper,
Miss Portnari replied.
You really did Harry Coyne very well. Probably just the way he'll do it when he gets up the nerve to come see me.
It was simpler than doing my own trip,
Hagbard said wearily.
My guilt is much deeper because I know more. It was easier to take his guilt trip than to take my own.
And it's over? Your fur no longer bristles?
I know who I am and why I'm here. Adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine.
How did you ever forget?
Hagbard grinned.
It's easy to forget. You know that.
She smiled back.
Blessed be, Captain.
Blessed be,
he said. Returning to his stateroom, he was still subdued. The vision of the self-begotten and the serpent eating its own tail had broken the lines of word, image, and emotional energy that were steering him toward the dark night of the soul again. But resolving his personal problem did not rescue the demonstration or help him cope with the oncoming disaster. It merely freed him to begin anew. It merely reminded him that the end is the beginning and humility is endless. It merely, merrily, turned the wheel another tarot-towery connection. He realized he was still tripping a little. That was readily fixed. Harry Coyne was tripping, and he was not Harry Coyne right now. Hagbard, remembering again who he was and why he was there, opened his stateroom door. Joe Malik sat in a chair, under an octopus mural, and regarded him with a level glance.
Who killed John Kennedy?
Joe asked calmly.
I want a straight answer this time, H.C.
Hagbard relaxed into another chair, smiling gently.
That one finally registered, eh? I told John all those years ago to emphasize that you should never trust anyone with the initials H.C., and yet you've gone on trusting me and never noticing.
I noticed, but it seemed too wild to take seriously.
John Kennedy was killed by a man named Harold Canvera, who lived on Fullerton Avenue in Chicago near the Seminary Restaurant where you and Simon first discussed his theories of numerology. Dillinger had moved back to that neighborhood for a while in the late 50s because he liked to go to the Biograph Theater for old time's sake, and Canvera was his landlord, very sane, ordinary, rather dull individual. Then, in Dallas in 1963, John saw him blow the president's head off before Oswald or Harry Coyne or the mafia gun could fire.
Hagbard paused to light a cigar.
We investigated Canvera afterward, like scientists investigating the first extraterrestrial life form. You can imagine how thorough we were. He had no politics at all at the time, which puzzled the hell out of us. It turned out that Canvera had put a lot of money into Blue Sky Inc., a firm that made devices for landing on low-gravity planets. It was back in the very early 50s. Finally, Eisenhower's hostility to the space program drove Blue Sky to the bottom of the board, and Canvera sold out at a terrible loss. Then Kennedy came in and announced that the U.S. was going to put a man on the moon. The stocks he'd sold were suddenly worth millions. Canvera's brain snapped. That was all. Killing Kennedy and getting away with it turned him schizzy, finally. He went in for spiritualism for a while, and then later joined White Heroes Opposing Red Extremism, one of the really paranoid anti-Illuminati groups, and ran a telephone message service giving whore propaganda.
And nobody else ever suspected?
Joe asked.
Canvera is still there in Chicago, going about his business, just another face on the street?
Not quite. He was shot a few years ago, due to you.
Due to me?
Yes, he was one of the subjects in their first arm test. He subsequently made the mistake of knocking up the daughter of a local politician. It appears that the arm made him susceptible to libertine ideas.
We're gonna rock, 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 till broad daylight.
You sound very convincing, and I almost believe you,
Joe said slowly.
Why all of a sudden? Why no more put-ons and runarounds?
We're getting to the chimes at midnight,
Hagbard replied simply, with a Latin shrug.
The spell is ending. soon the coach turns back to a pumpkin, Cinderella goes back to the kitchen, everybody takes their masks off, and the carnival is over. I mean it.
He added, his face full of sincerity.
Ask me anything, and you get the truth.
Why are you keeping George and me apart? Why do I have to skulk around the sub like a wanted fugitive and eat with Callie and Eichmann? Why don't you want George and me to compare notes?
Hagbard sighed.
The real explanation for that would take a day. You'd have to understand the whole Chiline system first. In the baby talk of conventional psychology and taking away George's father figures. You're one, his first and only boss, an older man he trusts and respects. I became another very quickly, and that's one of the thousand and one reasons I turned the guruhood over to Miss Portinari. He had to confront Drake, the bad father, and lose you and me, the good fathers, before he could really learn to ball a woman. The next step, if you're curious, is to take the woman away from him temporarily.
Hagbard added quickly.
Don't be so jumpy. You've been through a large part of the Chiline system and it hasn't killed you. You're stronger because of it, aren't you?
Joe nodded, accepting this, but shot the next question immediately.
Do you know who bombed Confrontation?
Yes, Joe. And I know why you did it.
You're not a thing at all.
Okay, then, here's the payoff, and your answer better be good. Why are you helping the Illuminati to immanentize the Eschaton, Hagbard?
It's steam engines when it comes steam engine time, as a very wise man once said.
Jesus,
Joe said wearily.
I thought I had crossed that palm, Asinorum. When I figured out how you get the goose out of the bottle in the Zen riddle, you do nothing and wait for the goose to peck its way out just like a chick pecks its way out of an egg, I realized, do what thou wilt becomes the whole of the law by a mathematical process. The equation balances when you realize who the thou is, as distinguished from the ordinary you. The whole fucking works, the universe, all of it, alive in the same way we're alive, and mechanical in the same way we're mechanical. The robot. The one more trustworthy than all the Buddhas and sages. Oh, Christ, yes, I thought I understood it all. But this stone fatalism. What the hell are we going to Ingolstadt for if we can't do anything?
The coin has two sides. It's the only coin that comes up at this time, but it still has two sides.
Hagbard leaned forward intensely.
It's mechanical and alive. Let me give you a sexual metaphor, since you usually hang out with New York intellectuals. You look at a woman across a room and you know you're going to bed with her before the night is over. That's mechanical. Something has happened when your eyes met. But the orgasm is organic. What it will be like, neither of you can predict. And I know, just as the Illuminati know, that immanentization is going to happen on May 1st because of a mechanical process Adam Weishaupt started on another May 1st 2 centuries ago, and because of other processes other people started before then and since then. But neither I nor the Illuminati know what form immanentization will take. It doesn't have to be hell on Earth, it can be heaven on Earth. And that's why we're going to Ingolstadt.
3 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock, rock.
I became a cop because of Billy Frechette. Well, I don't want to jive you. That wasn't the whole reason. But she sure as hell was one bodacious big part of the reason. And that's the curious thing about what finally happened and how Milo Flanagan assigned me to infiltrate the Linkin Park anarchist group, getting me in right up to my black ass and all that international intrigue and yoga-style balling with Simon Moon. But maybe I should start over from the beginning again, from Billy Frechette. I was a little kid, and she was an old woman. It was in the early 1950s, you see. Hassan I. Saba X was operating in the open then, going around the South Side preaching that the greatest of the white magicians had just died recently in England. And now the age of the black magicians was beginning. Everybody thought he was one stone crazy stud. And my father was a cook in a restaurant on Halstead. He pointed her out to me on the street once. It must have been just a while before she went back to the reservation in Wisconsin to die.
See that old woman, child? She was John Dillinger's girlfriend. Well, I looked, and I saw she was really heavy and together, and that whatever the law had done to her had never broke her. But I also saw that sorrow hung around her like a dark halo. Daddy went on and told me a lot more about her, and about Dillinger. But it was that sorrow that got printed all over every cell in my little baby brain. It took years for me to figure it out, but what it really meant, as an omen or conjure, was that she was basically just like the women of the black gang leaders on the South Side. Even if she was Indian. There's just one way for a black in Chicago, and that's to join a gang. Solidarity forever, as Simon would say. But I dug that there was only one gang that was really safe. The biggest gang of all, Mr. Charlie's Boys, the motherfucking establishment. I guess every black cop has that in the back of his head before he finds out that we never really can join that gang. Not as full members, anyway. I found out quicker, being not just black, but female. So I was in the gang, the baddest and heaviest gang, but I was always looking for something better, the impossible, the boss gimmick that would get me off the man's black and white chessboard entirely, into some place where I was myself and not just a pawn being moved around at Charlie's whim. Otto Waterhouse never had that feeling, at least not until near the end of the game. I never did get inside his head enough to know what was going on there. He was a real cop, and he got into my head almost as soon as we met, and I could always feel him watching me, waiting for the time when I would round on Charlie and go over to the other side. So the best I can do in making him is to say that he was no Tom in the ordinary sense. He didn't screw blacks for the man. He screwed blacks for himself. It was strictly his own trip. Otto was my drop after I got assigned to underground work. We met in a place that I could always have an excuse to visit, a run-down law firm called Washington, Weishaupt, Budweiser, and Keefe, on 23 North Clark. Later, for some reason I was never told, they changed the name to Ruley, Kemp, Shoveled, and Couth, and then to Weary, Stale, Flat, and Profitable. And to keep up the front, they actually did hire a couple of lawyers and did some real law work for a corporation called Blue Sky, Inc.
On April 29th, still harboring a cargo of doubt about Hagbard, Joe Malik decided to try the simplest method of tarot divination. Concentrating all his energy on the question, he cut the deck and picked out one card that would reveal Hagbard Chalene's true nature, if the divination worked. With a sinking heart, he saw that he had come up with the Hierophant. Running the mnemonic Simon had taught him, Joe quickly identified this figure with the number 5, the Hebrew letter vow, meaning nail, and the traditional interpretation of a false show, a hypocrisy or a trick. 5 was the number of grummet, the destructive and chaotic end of a cycle. Vow was the letter associated with quarrels, and the meaning nail was often related to the implement of Christ's death. The card was telling him that Hagbard was a hypocritical trickster aiming at destruction, a murderer of the dreamer-redeemer aspect of humanity. Or, taking a more mystical reading, as was usually advisable with the tarot, Hagbard only seemed to be these things, and was actually an agent of resurrection and rebirth. As Christ had to die before he could become the Father, as, in Vedanta, the false self must be obliterated to join the great self. Joe swore. The card was only reflecting his own uncertainty. He rummaged in the bookshelf Hagbard had provided for his stateroom and found 3 books on the tarot. The first, a popular manual, was absolutely useless. It identified the Hierophant with the letter of religion, in contrast to the spirit, with conformity, and with all the plastic middle-class values Hagbard conspicuously lacked. The second, by a true adept of the tarot, just led him back to his own confused reading of the card, remarking that the Hierophant is mysterious, even sinister. He seems to be enjoying a very secret joke at somebody's expense. The third work raised more doubts. It was Liber 555 by somebody named Mordecai Malignatus, which vaguely reminded Joe that the old East Village Other chart of the Illuminati conspiracy showed a Mordecai the Fowl in charge of the Sphere of Chaos. And Mordecai Malignatus was a fair Latinization of Mordecai the Fowl. Mordecai, Joe remembered, was, according to that half-accurate and half-deceptive chart, in dual control, along with Richard Nixon, then living, of the Elders of Zion, the House of Rothschild, the Politburo, the Federal Reserve System, the U.S. Communist Party, and Students for a Democratic Society. Joe flipped the pages to see what the semi-mythical Mord had to say about the Hierophant. The chapter was brief. It was in The Book of Republicans and Sinners, and said, 5. Vow, nail, the Hierophant. They nailed love to a cross, symbolic of their might. But love was undefeated. It simply didn't fight. 5 stone men were in a courtyard when an elephant entered. The first man was stoned on sleep, and he saw not the elephant, but dreamed instead of things unreal to those awake. The second man was stoned on nicotine, caffeine, DDT, carbohydrate excess, protein deficiency, and the other chemicals in the diet which the Illuminati have enforced upon the half-awake to keep them from fully waking. "Hey," he said, "there's a big smelly beast in our courtyard." The third stone man was on grass, and he said, "No, Dads, that's the ghostly old party in its true nature, the dark nix on the soul." And he giggled in a silly way. The fourth stone man was tripping on peyote, and he said, "You see not the mystery, for the elephant is a poem written in tons instead of words," and his eyes danced. The fifth stone man was on acid, and he said nothing, merely worshipping the elephant in silence as the father of Buddha. And then the Hierophant entered and drove a nail of mystery into all their hearts, saying, "You are all elephants." Nobody understood him. At 8 o'clock in Ingolstadt, an unscheduled group called the Cargo Cult managed to get the mic and began blasting out their own outer space arrangement of an old children's song. "She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes." And in Washington, where it was still only 2 in the afternoon, the White House was in flames, while the National Guard machine-gunned an armed mob crossing the mall in front of the Washington Monument, a single finger pointing upward in an eloquent and vulgar gesture which only the Illuminati knew meant, "Fuck you." In Los Angeles, where it was 11 in the morning, the bomb started to go off in police stations. And in Lehman Cavern, Markoff Cheney disgustedly pointed out a graffito to Saul and Barney. "Help stamp out sizism. Take a midget to lunch."
"You see?"
he demanded.
"That's supposed to be funny. It's not funny at all. Not one damn bit."
"She'll be driving 6 white horses. She'll be driving 6 white horses. She'll be driving 6 white horses when she comes."